If I were to ask you what history tells us, I think that you would answer simply, history tells us about the past. The point that I'd like to make this morning is that history, in fact, tells us far more about ourselves than it does about the past. I had occasion this past few days to reread the Haggadah. I hope some of you did too in preparation for the Seder. Now, all of us know the basic outline of the Exodus story. How the children of Israel went down to Egypt as free men, driven there by a famine in Canaan, eager to buy grain. How they were allowed to encamp in Goshen. Now they remained there for some generations. How there arose a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph. There was some political change of dynasty and of policy. And against all the laws of hospitality, these free men were suddenly overwhelmed and enslaved. How they were made to work on the storehouses of Pitom and Ramses, the great fortress cities of ancient Egypt. How the persecution grew until finally a law was passed that all the firstborn among the Hebrews must be put to death. How one Hebrew child was saved, as I read to you from the Bible this morning. How he was raised in the very palace of Pharaoh. How he walked out one day and saw an Egyptian taskmaster whipping one of the forced Hebrew laborers. How he killed that man and then was forced to go into exile to flee to Midian, that is Sinai. How he met there with Jethro, married his daughter, tended his flock, until one day he saw a bush that burned but was not consumed. He heard the voice of God speaking from the bush within him, telling him, go back, lead my people to their freedom. How armed with the power of God, with Aaron as his spokesman, he went back to Egypt, and he appeared before Pharaoh, and he said, let my people go. But Pharaoh was adamant, and one by one, harsh, ever more cruel plagues were inflicted upon the Egyptians, until Pharaoh, beset at the loss of his firstborn son and of the firstborn of all the homes of Egypt, finally allowed the Israelites to leave. How they left speedily and hastily at midnight, fearing that what in fact did happen would happen, that Pharaoh would change his mind. How hosts of Pharaoh pursued the Israelites to the very shores of the Red Sea. And the waters opened and allowed the Israelites to pass on dry land, but returned in the heads of the pursuing Egyptians and destroyed that army. And so they stood on the far bank of the Red Sea, and they sang the first song, Freedom. The story is so familiar to us that we are likely to assume that the book we have before us Seder night tells that story exactly as we know it. But I hope you'll look again, because the Haggadah achieves quite a literary triumph. It manages to tell the history of the Exodus without once mentioning the hero of the Exodus. Not once in that entire story is the name Moses mentioned. God brings about the freedom. God brings the miracle of the Red Sea. God brings the plagues upon the heads of the Egyptians. Now why? Do those who write the Haggadah not know the biblical story of Moses? Of course they did. But the Seder is designed not to be an historical commemoration, simply a rehearsal of events which happened 3,800 years ago in time. Rather, they are to be a statement of faith. It's to be an existential moment in which we rehearse the power of the God who thirsts for freedom, who demands freedom for himself and for mankind, by rehearsing all the events in the past in which the God of freedom established freedom, and reminding ourselves of that power is still present for us today. The biblical law reads, you shall tell your son in that day, saying. Saying what? Not that Moses brought the children out of Egypt, but that God brought the children out of Egypt. That God is the God who delivers. That he is with those, partner with those who seek the deliverance of all the oppressed and the persecuted of mankind. And that as he was with our fathers in those days, so will he be with us, with the liberators of this day. It reminds us that history is dead. The past is buried, as our children never cease to tell us. But it reminds us that from the past we learn the lessons of the present. And from those activities, that hope, that presence, the power of the divinity which is in the past, we can learn something about the promise and the possibility of life in our own times. No sooner had I put down the Haggadah than I picked up another book dealing with the life of Moses, written by a first century Hebrew philosopher and teacher who lived in Alexandria in Egypt, a man by the name of Philo, sometimes called Philo Judaeus. I was reading this particular book, The Life of Moses, for a chapter I was writing, but what struck me was the contrast between the Haggadah, written by Pharisees originally at about the same time as Philo, and this Life of Moses, written by a Greek-speaking Jew in a Greek-speaking congregation in the greatest Jewish metropolis of ancient times, in which Moses becomes a paragon, the man without peer, the man who most closely approximates perfection. Philo was born about 15 before the Common Era. He died around the year 30 in the Common Era. Philo was one of the greatest of the philosophers of the Hellenistic world. He was the product of a great Jewish metropolis. The city of Alexandria, of course, had been founded by Alexander the Great and named by him for himself. Jews had been among the first settlers brought there because of their sturdiness as craftsmen, their skills as artisans. They had thrived in that city. There were then, in the first century, probably 250,000 Jews in Alexandria. The great synagogue in Alexandria was supposed to have been so large that, lacking the modern means of electronic amplification, they had to put a man, a semaphore flagman, on the bima, on the pulpit, so that when the liturgist read the siddur, read the liturgy, and it came time for a congregational amen or some congregational response, he would wigwag the amen, so that those far distant in the corners of the synagogue would know this was the time to respond. Now, Philo was a son of the wealth of Alexandria. He had been taught by tutors. He'd been born into a rich family. He was trained in the best academies of the day. And he sought to express his tradition in the language of the Hellenistic Jewish world. He turns Moses into a philosopher king. The great Greek philosopher Plato, you recall, had assumed that the finest form of government was a government which would be organized by men who knew all, who were self-disciplined, who were wise above all else, and who were empowered with ultimate authority. And he describes the philosopher king, not simply a man who knows, who studies, and who writes. He's a man who is comely in form, perfect physically, whose mind and whose body are in perfect harmony. He is a man whose mind has understood the basic requirements of life, the basic dimensions of wisdom, whose mind controls his will, whose mind controls his passion, so that he is deliberate and grave and ethical and disciplined in all that he does. And Philo recasts the story of Moses so that Moses is transformed from an ancient Hebrew hero into a Greek philosopher king. He does no harm to the text. He simply takes the text and interprets it to fit his particular understanding. Obviously, a philosopher king among the Greeks was well born. The Bible, as I read to you this morning, says only that there was a man from the house of Levi who took a woman from the house of Levi, and they had a son. Philo says that Moses was born to one of the fine, noble families of the ancient Israelites. The Bible tells us nothing of the nature of this young child. Philo tells us that he was beautiful, that he was perfectly formed, that he never played with toys as did other children, or make a nuisance of himself, or make noise. Rather, he was always a mensch, a man. Rather, he was always controlled. He never whined, complained, was filled with self-pity. He had tutors, and he quickly learned his lessons. But more than that, his mind was so agile that he was always two steps beyond the lesson that the tutors were trying to inform him of. From his own, he was able to reach out beyond the wisdom of any man of his day. He was worthy of being raised in the royal family. All things then are attributed, all qualities are attributed to Moses. But more than that, a Greek philosopher king cannot be a passionate, impulsive person. I read to you how one day, walking from the palace, Moses had suddenly come upon this ugly scene of the taskmaster whipping the Hebrew, and he'd been so moved that he had been moved to murder the man who was beating the slave. Now, a philosopher does not react in that way. And the way that Philo tells the story is this. The children of Israel had come down to Egypt. They'd come down as free men. They had been criminally enslaved. As a philosopher, Moses went around trying to reason with people. He went to all the governors. He went to all the taskmasters. He tried to reason with them about the injustice of what they were doing. And there were some who were reasonable, who began to listen. But there was one more vicious and more cruel, a sadist among them, who would not listen, whose whole being was determined upon destruction, who enjoyed killing. And after all, is it not a virtue to destroy those whose sole purpose is to destroy mankind? Remember the great scene when Moses goes up to Mount Sinai and receives there the law. He's gone for 40 days and for 40 nights, and when he descends, he finds that the children of Israel have proved faithless, that they have taken all of their ornaments, their gold, and they have built for themselves the golden calf, and they're dancing in a bacchanalian fashion in front of the calf, offering to this idol their loyalty. And you remember how Moses takes the tablets, the law, and raises them high and shatters them in his anger? Well, philosopher king doesn't respond in that way. When Philo tells the story, Moses is up in the mountain for 40 days, and way up in the mountain, the thin air brings to him the voice of the Bacchanalian chant. He hears and he knows what's happening back in the camp. And what does he do? He does nothing until his heart is calmed within him, because a philosopher never acts impulsively. And then he begins to utter a prayer to God to forgive this people. He calms himself, and then he goes down determined not to be angry, but to pray for the people, not to be vindictive, but to save all those who are not so given over to idol worship, who are not simply carried away by the moment, to save as many of his people as he can, and so he does. And Philo manages to tell this whole episode without once describing the actual shattering of the commandments. Now, what has Philo done? He has explained the story of Moses as he felt he knew it, as he understood it. He has not deliberately set out to pervert it. He has not simply set out to put it in different terms so that it may be more appealing. Rather, leadership in his day was represented by the philosopher king. Moses was the greatest of leaders. Everything that Moses did could be explained in terms of the virtues of a great philosopher, so it was done by Philo. Now, my point is this, that we can see the mote in the eye of a Greek philosopher who lived 1950 years ago. That's easy. But can we see the mote in our own eye? can we see how what we call history is in fact what we have wanted to find in the past, how looking for it we have found it. We live in a generation which has seen the creation of history. We have seen it particularly among the blacks in America. There were black people since the history of man began. They lived, they ruled, they had their wars, they had their wise men, they had their medicine, they had their science. They moved into the Arab world, they moved in the European world, they moved into the American world, and many of them had success, more moderate or more success. But there was no black history until the black community of America came to the point when it needed to find in the past its roots and its dignity. And what did they find when they looked back? They found what they looked for. The middle class, the moderates among them, found Crispus Attucus and Booker T. Washington. The moderate men, the loyalists, the patriots, those who contributed to the nation. And the more radical among them found a different history. Malcolm X and Eldridge Cleaver, the history of those who were given to the black militant revolution. In each case, the history which they found was not the totality of the past. Their understanding was not what the past was, but what they needed the past to be. And so it has always been. But with all historians and with all peoples, we use the past to help us forge the myths by which we organize the present. And we're never quite conscious of it. I give you the ultimate in paradox. The man who taught us most about the strange, deep byways of the human mind was Sigmund Freud. The man who taught us most about projection, who taught us how much of what we think to be true is in fact self-illusion. Well, Freud dealt in a very interesting way with Moses. For some reason, this is the interesting fact, he abandoned his psychoanalytical work to write one historical book. He called it Moses and Monotheism. And Moses, the Moses of Sigmund Freud, is one of the most unique of the recreations of Moses that has ever been penned. I must give you a little history. About 50 years before the Exodus is supposed to have taken place, there was a young pharaoh in Egypt by the name of Iknahatan. And Iknahatan came to power on the back of an anti-priestly, anti-ecclesiastic revolution. The priests had won great power. The great temples were the treasuries of ancient Europe. They held most of the land of ancient Egypt. They held most of the land of Egypt. And there was a monarchist attack upon this ecclesiastic upper-class opposition to royalist power. And Iknahatan was the figurehead, and what they tried to do was to claim that there were not many gods, each of whom had his own priestly cult, but there was only one god, Aton, the solar disk. All gods are, in a sense, part of this one god, that those who have been telling you that Thoth or Ishtar or Ra are the supreme gods have been lying to you, their power must be broken, that only the priests of Aton are to be believed, and of course all the priests of Aton were members of Iknahatan's party. Iknahatan ruled for just a dozen years or so. His power was quickly broken and the power of the priests was reasserted. And according to Freud, Moses was an Egyptian nobleman, not a Jew at all, one who had been part of Iknahatan's group, probably a governor, perhaps a prince, who had fled the repression which had followed inevitably upon the crushing of Iknahatan's revolution. He had fled into the wilderness, and he'd found there a ragtag of wandering ex-slaves of Semitic peoples who had somehow escaped from Egypt, and he took them over by force of his personality, and he forged them into a people worshiping the solar disk Aton, which for some reason he gave the name Yahweh or Adonai. that Moses was an Egyptian who imposed his discipline upon this wandering motley of Israelites or Hebrews, and then by force of his personality led them to the promised land, which was itself a myth which he gave to them. Now what have we here? Why does this founder of psychoanalysis give us a myth about Moses the Egyptian? Remember Freud's biography. He was born and raised in Vienna, in the midst of the most anti-Semitic city in Europe. During the early days of his career, Vienna was ruled by a mayor who had been elected on the anti-Semitic party. That was its name. He was refused again and again admission into hospitals because people said the Jews are too smart by far. What was he saying in this recreation? Was it perhaps that the Jews are not too smart by far? That the uniqueness of the Jew was imposed upon them from the outside? That the idea of a promised land was imposed upon them from the outside? Give us another leader. Give the Jew their freedom. Give them new ideas and they will become something else. They will integrate, assimilate into the society. They are not different, racially, intellectually, or any otherwise. Only the chance of history gave them the history which is theirs. Perhaps I misread Freud, but it's the reasons why a psychoanalyst should stroll in the byways of history into a world in which he is not simply that competent would indicate that something drove him to recreate Moses in the image of his own needs. And I suspect he would not have been surprised to know that he was capable of doing what all other ordinary mortals, according to him, did ordinarily. Moses has been used in wondrous and fascinating ways in our past. But of course, the question really is, how are we using Moses? When I speak of Moses to you, what immediately comes to your mind? I asked a youngster the other day in my class at the university what came to her mind when I spoke of Moses, and the scene that came to her mind instinctively was the scene of Moses striking down the taskmaster, the instinctive reaction to evil, to ugliness. What came into your mind? I suspect that we make a great deal of Moses the liberator. Freedom is very much a part of the thrust of our society. I suspect we make a great deal of Moses who leads the children of Israel to the promised land. Israel is again central as a theme in our lives. Occasionally we remind ourselves that Moses went up to Sinai and received the Ten Commandments. When I talk of Moses with the Ten Commandments over my shoulder, how can we not think of that? But only occasionally. And how many of us think of the Moses who sat day by day for 40 years before the tent of meeting, dispensing the Torah, the very specific requirements of the faith, the laws of the regimen, the discipline, the requirements, the specifics? The Ten Commandments are fine, they're broad, they're humane, they're universal. But the Torahs are specific. You shall observe the Passover, you shall observe Shavuot, you shall observe these dietary laws, you shall observe these laws of purity. This shall be the law for marriage for you. These we tend to forget. This part of the life of Moses we tend to push aside. We don't like to think of religion as being an encompassing discipline with hard, harsh specifics, do we? We like to think of it as being broad, universal, full of love and compassion and sympathy and a thirst for righteousness, but not different. That's not our way. And so when we recreate Moses, this is rarely the Moses that we describe to our children. Who do you think of when you think of Moses? Amen.